So this is a day of fasting. The first thing you think of when you hear there's going to be a fast, yay! There's going to be a fast. I had somebody ask me what the fast was all about. And I said, it was in the letter. And the person said, I didn't get any letter. And I said, I sent it to everyone. And he goes, I never get anything from you. And it dawned on me, I said, do I not have your right email address? And he says, well, I've changed it. I said, but you didn't tell me you changed it. And he goes, oh, it's different now. So, okay. So I said, well, give me your email address and I'll send it to you. And he says, okay. You take that, took care of that. And then he says, so what's this fast about anyway? So, all right. Well, and so I started trying to explain it to him. It'd been, almost 10 days since I'd read the letter. So I'm just going, the church wants to be effective. They want to want to do the commission that we've been given, and they want us to do what we can do. And so they're asking us to pray and ask for God's wisdom and God's direction. And he's like, oh, all right. And I went home thinking about that conversation. And I said, did I sum that up right? And so I went back and I read the letter again. And I got a different take the second time through it. The first time, I had that same experience that I'm sure we got. Oh, there's going to be a fast. Yay. And, okay, so what's this about? And so I'm looking. Is there some big world event? Or is there something going to happen? Because in the past, they've asked for people in the church to fast because there was a big decision the church was about to make. And we wanted to make sure we're all on the right page. And so in those kinds of cases, we sort of fast on behalf of the organization. They're going to go into this room. They're going to go into the huddle. And we want God to inspire that huddle. And we want the best decision to come out. And so, yeah, we'll lend our voices in prayer to that. And we'll lend our stomachs to that. And I thought, did I give that person the impression that that's what this is? That we are just fasting on behalf of church administration to do better at their job? And so when I went back and looked at it, like I said, I got a different look at it. And, you know, we fast for all the reasons I think we could all agree to, and we could write our own list. We want to draw close to God. We want to show him that we are weak, he is strong, that we cannot make it without him, that we are willing to put aside those things which our body is telling us that it wants because we want first what God wants. And so those are all the things that you can do. And you can, and I was talking about this earlier, there's lots of things you could give up to show God that you're all for him. And we usually pick food because that's the example that's in our Bibles. But you could tell, God, say, God, until I don't know if I should buy this house or if I should take this job. So until I get the answer from you, I'm going to, you fill in the blank, whatever it is, whatever sacrifice, whatever thing you'd want to do. And you could do that to show God that his advice is more important to you. Of course, we get the example, of course, from atonement, where God wants us to afflict our souls, and there's a lot of themes around atonement that aren't applicable in this situation, why we're fasting here, but the answer is still the same. We want to draw close to God, and we want him to work in this situation and be a part of it. So this fast, though, is a little different in that it is not a fast on behalf of an organization like the church has called a few in the past. This time, when you look at the seal, and on the top it says preaching the gospel, on the bottom it says preparing a people. What part of that do you see as your job? What part of that seal do you say, I can relate to that? Yeah, that's for me. Usually it's in the prepare a people. We think about the idea that what manner of person should we be? Prepare the bride for Christ. And we need to make sure that we are the type of people that God wants in his family. And we think about those. And then when we think about the preaching the gospel part, yeah, that has to happen. That's a prophetic thing. And we have the history of, if you've been in the church for many decades, you've watched how preaching the gospel works. And back in the early days of the church, what did the members do to preach the gospel? Nothing. You just watched them walk through the door. Sometimes every week there'd be a new family. There was no participation. I mean, there was participation once they got into the church, but to actually bring them to the door, I mean, we used to make comparisons between us and people that might ride a 10-speed or go door-to-door and hand out literature and say, we're not like them. You know, God does the calling. And so it was very convenient that God did the work. He did the heavy lifting of preaching the gospel. We did our part. We, you know, contributed to the organization. The organization put out the literature, and they came by the tens of thousands. But think about it. How many of those people that you watched for all those decades come in, how many of those people are still here in the church? At one time in the early 90s, just in the church that I was in, over 200, no, almost 250,000 people attended in like 93, somewhere around there, 93, 94. And even as that organization was kind of coming apart at the seams, it was growing incredibly fast. Where are those people today? Are they in any organization? Most of them not. I mean, one thing, if you say, well, there's, you know, 75 churches of God, if throwing a number out there, and that's probably a big number that's bigger than it should be, but whatever the number is, add them all up. It isn't anywhere near 100,000, I don't believe. Where are all those people? So we saw this growth from preaching the gospel. We saw huge lightning growth. And the question we might want to ask ourselves today is that the right way? Is that the way that God expects people to come into the church? Now, obviously it was for him to do so, because he wouldn't have done so otherwise. But we're trying to do this, as we've talked about, to set an example to the rest of the world so that they know that it's possible. And I don't think the best example we give them is, well, we got 200,000, 300,000, I mean, if you add up everybody, who knows how many there were, 250,000 people, they all came in. Of course, only a small, tiny fraction of them stayed. What does that tell the rest of the world for their chances? You know, at least they attended for a while. And it's kind of sad when you think about all those people. And so when I read Bible prophecy about a lot of people that are going to be coming into the church in the end days, I do happen to think a lot of those people that God called may come back. And there's some kind of dark imagery about washing your robes in blood and things like that that are kind of hard to think about. But I do believe a lot of those people will come back, as God had planned to call them for a reason. But is that what we're supposed to do at this point? Just get ourselves, get our house in order, and then let God do the work. Basically, yeah. Let God do the work. That doesn't mean there's something we shouldn't be doing, whether that's through the methods that we've been doing, through print media, and this big push on the internet is all the rage right now, and we might have some part to play there. But it's always God that does the increase. We're about getting ourselves ready. The title of the sermon today is not of my own. It was one that we had for the GCE the year before the split. And it was Preaching the Gospel, a Whole Church Effort. And, you know, for some of the people that were there at that at that particular GCE, this was a very popular theme. And for some of the people in the church back then, it was not a popular theme. And because some felt it was kind of spitting in the eye of what Mr. Armstrong had done for all those years, where, you know, the church went out and put out a broadcast, and that broadcast drew people in. And when you say that this is a whole church effort, are you asking people to start investing in 10 speeds and start going door to door? No, that's not what it was about. The title does talk about our role, though, in preaching the gospel, because I think each of us has a role. And I don't believe it's getting on a street corner on a soapbox. I don't believe it is trying to convert your coworkers or your neighbors, for that matter. But I do believe there is a role. So when you think about why you're here, what kind of thing comes to mind? Other than what I hope you have similar to me is, I'm sure lucky God has called me. When you get past the, wow, I can't believe he picked me of all the people in this world, then what do you think? When you read that letter that the Council of Elders wrote, it was focused on us as individuals. It wasn't focused on, you know, we'd sure like to invest this much more money into this method or that method, but we really don't know if this is the right decision or not. It wasn't that at all. It was, what manner of person might we ought to be? And could we all fast together, seek God's will, and say, who are we? Why has God called us? Why are we here in this room? Is it simply to just pass the time until his son returns? And then we'll be given something to do. And I think that was a thrust of that letter. Certainly what I took from the heart of it. What have we been called to do? Now, we can look at the fruit of someone and say, that someone's on the right course. They're on the right track. They're doing all the right things. And no matter who you look at, you're going to find people with faults. We all have faults. And once in a while, those faults spill out and cause problems between one another and maybe even with our own personal family or with our neighbor in the church. And we're human. We have these issues that come about. But for the most part, we're all trying to get there. We all have the goal in mind, and we're all trying to be that. So what are we to learn from this fast as a result of this? So if we are all sort of on the same page, that God has called us for a purpose, we're here trying to figure that out. We don't do a good job every day, but we're trying. What more is there than that? One of the things that we do with a fast is we look at ourselves. We examine ourselves. We have kind of no choice but to think of ourselves when our stomach is, you know, growling. I was just asking someone this morning, where does that sound come from? What is that noisemaker that's in your stomach that's actually generating the sound? You know, it sounds like the little spokes with the playing card on your bicycle when it goes by. It's like, what makes that sound? I mean, it's kind of hard not to think inwardly when you're fasting. What should we be thinking about? Is there anything in our lives that we can learn? How many people in this room are not in any way on social media? No Facebook, no Twitter, no Snapchat. What are some other ones? Instagram. None of those. Can you see the hands again? Oh, about maybe a quarter of the congregation. And so, if you think this next section isn't related to you in any way because you raised your hand, I'm not leaving anybody out. But it's good to see the number. When you if you talk to somebody that spends any time online, you can ask them this question and you'll get an answer for sure. How many people do you know that in the last year or two have sent out a message to their people that they communicate with, through their friends or however the social media works and say, I've had enough. I'm done with this. There's just been so much drama. I don't want any part of it. A lot of it came out because of the presidential election. You can understand a lot of the things that happened because of that. But that's not the only reason. People talk about, I can't stand the negativity that's on there. Now, if you just look at it as a medium by itself and say, yeah, the internet can be really a nasty place if you're not careful. You can go to a good part of town, or you could wind up in a really bad part of town, and you won't feel very safe there. So for somebody to say, I've had enough, there's too much drama, that's understandable, especially to those of us that don't spend a lot of time on social media. But for those 75% that do spend a lot of time on social media, who are you communicating with? Who do you spend all your time talking to? Who do you spend all your time listening to? People you care about. Many of them in the church. Some of them not. But they're people that we use the term friend. We friend them. And I do know that there is that desire in some of these social media systems to have as many friends as you possibly can. So you just friend. I don't know who they are. I'll just keep clicking friend. And then they will, if half of them respond, it looks like I got a lot of friends, you know. And I joke all the time, my wife's got over 500 friends on Facebook, and I said, I don't know 500 people. So I can't kind of wrap my brain around that. So if you got 500 friends on Facebook, what's the possibility that you're going to see some negative stuff? What's the possibility of you're going to see stuff that maybe isn't negative, but isn't all that useful? How much of the percentage of that time do you suppose there is? You would be surprised. I'm not saying that people don't share wonderful, warm stories. And let's not discount all those cat videos. Those are important. But there are, I look at it from the outside as it's good that we're connected. Through my wife's account, I know what's going on. When somebody gets sick, when somebody needs prayers, there's a lot of good that goes on with the system. But when somebody says, I've had enough, I just can't take the drama anymore. And I started reading through this letter. It reminded me, I might not know a whole lot about social media, but I do know a lot about this topic in one respect. I spent over 20 years of my professional life outside of the ministry in customer support. Customer service. I started my own business, and so I had that understanding. I then became a paid consultant. I did that for a while. And then I took over a division of tech support for a large school where we had thousands and thousands of computers and people to take care of. And over 20 years, I will tell you this, I did learn a few things. And I can speak with authority that these things are true. The first thing I learned in business is you cannot sell to people who don't know you and that you don't have a relationship with of some sort. You know, you walk up and you say, hey, I've got a business. I'm interested in doing some service for you. Yeah, I'm not interested in forking over money to somebody I don't know. You know, maybe if they're desperate. And oftentimes you get customers because they are desperate. They've broken something and no one else will come. And it's through your showing up and fixing them and getting them out of a jam, they said, you're an all right guy. I'm going to call you again. And it's because of the relationship that these people will pay for services. As a consultant, I would tell people what they needed to spend money on. Now, because at the time I got paid as a percentage of what they spent money on, you can see how this could go horribly wrong. You know, everybody knows about you go in for that oil change and they tell you you need $900 worth of repairs. You might, you might not. How do you trust? Can you trust the guys at whatever lube to tell you that you need to spend $900? I don't know them. I'd rather say thank you, get the list, and then take it to someone I trust and say, are any of these things really wrong with my car? Because you don't trust them. So I spent my time as a consultant building relationships with people. And when I first got started, I found out, I said, you know, when I was in my business, it took years to build a handful of customers that were loyal, good customers. Consulting isn't going to be that much different. I don't really think I can take 10 years to build up a clientele so that I'm busy all the time. I need to figure out a shortcut to do this. And so what I did was I went to each of the other consultants that worked there and I said, do you have any clients that you just despise? Do you have any clients that you just, they call you and you just say, I'm not picking that line up today. I'll talk to them tomorrow. And every consultant that worked where I did had at least two or three. Those were my customers. That's how I got started. I picked all of the customers that nobody else wanted. And I thought to myself, how do I make relationships with people that generally don't like to pay bills, don't like to take your advice, like to be angry when they don't take your advice and something goes wrong just like you said it was. And that's why they didn't like those customers. And so you learn to build trust with these people. And as trust builds, all of a sudden when I said, you know, this device's days are numbered, let me just tell you what you're looking at. If it doesn't fail on a bad day, this is what it's going to cost you. But if it fails on a bad day, this is what it's going to cost you. And all of a sudden, all right, do it, whatever it costs. And bad clients became good clients because, not because I was a great salesman, not because I was a great computer technician, but because I had trust and I built relationships with them. Then when I moved into customer support at a school, I began to notice things. Now I'm not doing it personally. I've got a team of people doing this, and I'm managing this team. And I'd get these calls. Can you not send so-and-so here anymore? When so-and-so comes, my day is always going to be less good, you know? And so, what is it with so-and-so? Sometimes so-and-so gets up there and talks about their life, and their life isn't great. Their life is not so great. And so-and-so goes up there and says, yeah, my daughter's just always after me, trying to get money out of me. I need to kick her out of the house. And those are the conversations that he has as he's trying to help someone. People don't want that. They don't want their support person to come there and unload all of their problems. They don't have a relationship with this guy. And this guy isn't trying to build a relationship with him. He's just saying whatever he feels like. And then we had a version of social media going back 20 years that wasn't like Facebook. We called it the water cooler. And it was just a message board, that electronic. And you could post your favorite recipe. You could ask somebody what fishing lure works in this river. You could say, hey, anyone knows how to check if a water heater works or not? I mean, whatever it is. It might just be, heard this great joke today. They had to kibosh that pretty quickly. Jokes didn't turn out to be very good. And I had one employee that loved to post in the water cooler. And everything that person posted divided people. Everything from politics to religion to how you should educate your kids, whether you should or shouldn't do this, whether this health food thing or that thing it should be done, basically just preaching about life. And I kept getting calls from the administration saying, you know, if this person's going to keep posting, I know you can post whatever you want, but people don't want the person around. And so I take this person aside and said, these are your opinions. Some of them I might share with you. Some of them I don't. But if you share these opinions with the public, you divide them. And you have people on one side that think you're great. And why haven't we heard this more of? We need more of this. And then we have people on the other side that say, I can't stand those things that get posted. I just can't stand it anymore. And I was thinking about this as I was reading the letter. And I thought, if I could offer someone up the opportunity to get a message out to the whole world, and the internet is one of those ways. You get a viral message, they like to call it, and all of a sudden everyone, who hasn't heard about the guy being drug off United Airlines? I mean, when it gets out there and it takes fire, everyone sees it. And so if I could say, here's a telegram, remember those? No, nobody remembers. No one here has ever used, anyone here actually sent a telegram? One. We have one person that sent a telegram. But you had to pay per letter or per word? Total number of words you paid for. And then they would send that anywhere in the world, right?
I don't know about that. I'd send it to somebody.
But you'd send it to someone and somebody had to deliver it. Okay. So you would pay for so many words. If I told you you could have so many words, and it's going to go out to whoever you want, and we're going to say the world, how much time would you spend before you wrote those words? Because I can tell you on some of the posts that I've read, that I've got to see, I'm thinking a millisecond went by before some of those comments were written. I mean, it's like the first thing that pops out of my mind, I got to write it down! And they send it out to the world. And you look at it and you said, these are church people. Why are they writing this? How is this going to help somebody come to Christ? How is this going to do anything to help anybody? But hey, it's their opinion. And their opinion's important. And I used to tell those guys in the support business, if you share your opinions, you lose your customers. I want you to turn over to Matthew 25. We actually will use the Bible here in this message. This is one of the passages that were quoted in the letter. Story you all know. I could ask you individually, tell me about the story, and you would all tell me the story, and I doubt many of the details will be left out. But there's a reason we're going to read through this. Because it's just the first part of this that I want to talk about. Matthew 25, starting in verse 1. Then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened unto 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now 5 of them were wise, and 5 of them were foolish. What do you think was what made them wise or what made them foolish? We say, well, it's because they brought oil in their lamps. They were thinking ahead. And we give them that credit for thinking ahead. And the ones who did not bring enough oil, they were not thinking ahead, so they were foolish. Now, this is one of those super important kingdom parables that all of us should be able to relate to. And so I've seen sermons where people say, well, you know, the oil represents the Holy Spirit, and you got to make sure if you don't have the Holy Spirit, life is going to tear you down and you're not going to make it. And you say, okay, I like the analogy. It works for me. Is that something enough that everyone should be able to relate to on itself? I read through this whole section, and at the end I asked myself, how did God know who was the wise and who was the foolish? Now, all it had to be was the bridegroom came in and said, show me your lamps. Is that all you brought? You brought extra. You didn't bring extra. See ya. Goodbye. Why did the bridegroom delay his return? The trial here isn't what they remembered to bring. The trial here was not tribulation. This isn't the one where you had to keep working, or if you get drunk and you start beating your fellow servants, then you're out. This isn't the one where you had to double what you've been given, or 10 times what you've been given, or else you're out. What's the trial here? What separates the men from the boys, if we use that phrase? Time. That's the only thing to endure in this parable. Time. $250,000 people showed up for the feast one year. They liked what the message was. They wanted the outcome. They talked about the return of the king. They anticipated it. They celebrated it. They feasted together. And today they're not here. And what's gone between then and now is time. That's what separated these wise and foolish virgins. If you could have said to them as they were showing up to wait for the bridegroom, by the way, I don't know how long this is going to take. This could go all night. I would put money on the fact that some of the five that failed would say, oh, well, then I'll come back later. Some of those I think we could figure out right off the bat. They said, I'm not ready for that. I thought we're showing up on time. I'm on time. But to really know if they were going to stand the test of time, you had to have the test of time. And so those of us that have been in the church for... Anyone been... I got 4 decades. Anyone's got 4 decades? Raise your hands. A lot of hands. Anyone got 5? Well, we got a couple 5. Yep. About almost a quarter of you got 5 decades or more. That's a long time. That's a long time that oil has to last. And so what is the fruit of someone that's been in for decades? That's what we're supposed to be praying and fasting about. What manner of person has God called to preach the gospel unto the world as a witness, as an example? And you don't get to know how long. You don't get to know how long you have to be here. And the only way God knows is if you've got the stomach for it, is He's going to make you wait for it. So when you think about what we are to do with our time, I want to ask you a question. Do you understand, and probably you do, as a minister, I've had a lot of at-bats to stand up in front of a congregation and say, I've prepared a message from this book to give to you. And I want to communicate that message to you. And I can tell you after a number of years, I've seen fruit as a result of some of that communication. Not the kind of fruit that I think a lot of people would brag about. You know, it's not like I said, you know, look at that orchard. You know, I planted one tree 5 years ago, and now there's 1,000 trees, and they're all so full of fruit, I can't even give it away, so much of it. I can't say I've got that kind of a track record, no way. But I have had a small influence, nudged the ship a little to the right direction. And I think with all that effort that I've put into all of those messages, if I can just nudge that massive ship a little bit in the right direction, that might be all I get out of all the years that I've been given. I don't know. All of you don't get this opportunity. what is your opportunity to nudge that ship in the right direction? Something to think about today. Turn over to 1 Corinthians 9. I want to talk about polarizing topics again. We all do this. We all have points of view. And once in a while, I'll be talking to somebody about something I think we both have in common. I find out, oh, I guess we don't have this in common. And I think, wow, I sure hope I didn't damage this relationship. I don't want to. Whether I'm right about X, Y, or Z, or I'm wrong about X, Y, or Z, is far less important than this trust that we're trying to build here. And we've talked about this before. But let's look at what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 9. Now remember, we talked about 1 Corinthians being written about the time of this, unleavened bread, spring holiday season. This could have come as a result of their behavior just past the Passover, and he was nailing them kind of right after the fact. This could be right before the Passover because of last year's conduct. I don't know. But it's referring to this time of year and how we should be thinking as we look at the spring holy days. But 1 Corinthians 9 is not focusing on the Passover. It's focusing on something from the letter, and that is the gospel. So let's take a look at 1 Corinthians 9, starting in verse 16. For if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for necessity is laid upon me. That's why I've been called. I've been called to deliver these messages to the world, maybe one congregation at a time. And I put them out there on the internet, and somebody might go by and see, hey, I was searching for this topic, your title came up, and somebody out in the world might hear something that is said right to everybody here. And so I have this limited thing. Is that such a great thing? No, because that's the commission that I've been given. I have nothing to boast of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yes, woe is to me if I do not preach the gospel. So don't say it's a great thing that you got a chance to preach the gospel. That's what we've been called to do. For if I do this willingly, I have a reward. But if it's against my will, I have been entrusted with a stewardship. What is my reward then? So if I'm only here because I kind of want the reward, I'm not really in for all of the drama that goes between here and there, I might find I'm one of these people that only come to church on Passover. Because if being around people all year round just brings me down. I might be one of those people. Or I might be one of these people that I'd be here if life wasn't so busy. And when I can fit it in, I'll be here. And so there's these different ways of looking at it. But if you do this willingly, and I'm not talking about attending church, but actually being a part of what God is doing, and you are an active part, then yes, there is that reward. And for those that aren't in it for the right reason, God's going to wait us out, and that oil's going to run out, and then it's going to be, I don't have the stomach for any longer. Isn't that sad to think somebody might be in the church for 50, 60 years, and then quit right before the end? Can you imagine that? What a time to quit after all that time. Going on, Paul describes the mission to preach the gospel not out of obligation, but because he wants to. He says that when I preach the gospel, I may present the gospel of Christ without charge, that I may not abuse my authority in the gospel. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more. Now think about this conversation I had with this fella that I said, when you post in the water cooler how you think that people who don't like guns are idiots, or that you think that the education system for which you work for is a complete farce? Or do you think that the government is out to get you? Or you think, and it doesn't matter, there's 100 posts. Do you think this is going to endure you to the people that are going to call and say, can you help me? Let's keep reading here. For though I am free of all men, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law. Do you think that when Paul was around Jews, he says, everything you said is right. Peter and those guys are crazy. I'm with you. Is that how he won them over? I don't think so. Or else he wouldn't have stood Peter to his face and said, you're double-minded. Something that was in the letter. Double-minded. When you're in front of this group, this is how you are, Peter. But when you're away from them, you're different. You know, you don't have any problem sitting with Gentiles when they're the only ones in the room. But once the Jews come in, the Pharisees show up, you move over to their table. And you're a respecter of persons. So no, when Paul says, to the Jew I became to a Jew, that I might win those to who are under the law, he shared with them what they had in common. And they had a lot in common. He didn't go say, hey, let me tell you the 45 things you got wrong. I just met you yesterday, so it's going to take the rest of the day. That's not what Paul did. He shared what they had in common, and he led them as he built trust with them. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. In verse 21, to those who are without the law, as without the law. You don't go up to a Gentile's house and say, I can't believe you're eating that. You have no business doing this. What's that thing in your yard? You need to tear that altar down right now. Is that how he won the Gentiles over? Or did he share with them that which would inspire and lead them in the right direction? Not being, talking about these people not being in the law as the Jews understood it at that time. That I might win those who are without law. And then he says, to the weak I became as weak. Somebody tells you, you know, I'm having some real financial troubles. Is that when you say, yeah, I just finished Dave Ramsey's program and I'm wealthy? Is that when you share that information? Probably not. You might share a time when you could relate to what they're going through. You know, I remember a time that I went through the exact same thing you did. And this is what we have in common. These are things that Paul is saying, and he's telling the church in Corinth who were divided. They're the rich, the poor, the well-to-do, the slave, the free, all these different groups and factions. And they didn't really want a lot to do with one another. And he was telling them how to behave as a congregation so that they could be unified. I have become all things to all men that I might be by all means save some. That's a huge investment for a little return. If you think about that, he's all in. He will be all things to all people. That's an absolute statement. That he might win some. It kind of gives you an idea of how big this job that we've been called to really is. That I might be, by all means, save some. If I could just reach someone, if I could nudge this ship just a few inches, we might avoid that iceberg. And that might be all that I'm here for. Why are you in the church? Why did God call you? What part of this great work does he expect you to do? And to remind them back at the beginning what he said about the gospel, in verse 23, he finishes up this section. Now, this I do for the gospel's sake, that I may be partaker of it with you. this mission of trying to bring people together and bring people who might think differently than us, but not in a divisive way, but in a way that would build relationships, start trust, and then bring people together, is what Paul was doing. And he was trying to share that with them, that they are partakers of that same gospel. So ask yourself, you have this opportunity, for those of us that are on Facebook, to communicate with the whole world, at least through your friends, and it might go viral. What are you going to post? Do you ever mention your faith? Not that you need to be this tremendous Facebook preacher, but is that what they see most of you, is your faith? And then when you share your faith, do you it like that Pharisee did? I thank God that I'm not like those other people. I fast twice in the week. I thank God I'm not like them. Look what I've done. Probably not the best thing to share. I think if we had Pharisees today on Facebook in the church like there were back then, they would be posting things about how I thank God I'm not like those Gentiles. I circumcise my kids. I go out and I make sure that that animal is bled good, and I make sure that I keep the law. And I know people in the church that don't, not like that. And I'm glad I'm not like that. Who is that person going to win over? Other Pharisees. He definitely will win over other Pharisees. That's what happens a lot of times when somebody posts a controversial topic that kind of lights up and catches fire, that people who feel the same way will pat you on the back and say, I'm glad someone had the courage to say that. You ever seen someone say something like that? That needed to be said. It's about time this world gets straightened out. Can you straighten out someone you have no relationship with? I hope you can straighten out your friends, your family, your loved ones when they get off track. And you do so with love. And you do so with the relationship you have built and you've been building. And you've got skin in the game. You know, there's an interesting concept. And I don't know how this would work in a game, like a kind of a field game. But I know they have these deals where you have the water cannons. I know Mrs. Aratola has done this, where you shoot in the water cannon, you're trying to fill up this bucket, and if you fill up this bucket, then whatever is in the bucket comes out, and you win. What if you had a concept like this, where the only way you could win is you could fill up someone else's? If you could make someone else's fill up, then you would win. Well, of course, they have games like that. And the problem is the person whose cup runneth over doesn't win. Because the rule was you have to make someone else's overflow. But what if actually making someone else win was the only way you could move forward in the game? And that every time you stop to add anything to your bucket, you fall back. You lose ground. What about a world like that? Anybody know someone who you would call them, when I was in school, morning people? Who are morning people? They were those people who are bright and happy without caffeine. And they come to class, get all your homework done? And he's like, shut up. I haven't had my coffee yet. Morning people, happy people. Everybody knows someone who's happy. You ever known somebody who's been happy for 50 years? Are they as happy as they were when they were young? I would put money on the fact that if you knew 10 happy people in your life, they wouldn't all be as happy today as they once were. And the reason why is a simple fact of human nature. They are effervescent and they give. They're givers. They see positive things. You know, they don't see the horse manure, they see the pony. You know, they're positive people. And when you put positive people and negative people together, Negative people feel like they're being pushed. Negative people feel like, you want me to be positive like you. I'm not going to be positive like you. Not with this level of caffeine in my blood. And so you just kind of rebuff them. And positive people get rebuffed a lot. You've seen it. Maybe you've done it. What happens to that shine that that person has over time? Again, we're talking about this thing of time. When time goes by, all of a sudden, it's like, you know, I go into that room, and I've heard people, I can't tell you how many times I tell people that complain that, you know, I go into work and I try to get everyone excited about what we have to do, and I get sick of it. I get sick of the attitudes that people have. Why can't people just be happy? And the reason why that happens is because you can't have one spark plug for an 8-cylinder engine. It won't run. You know, in an engine, if you have a V8 and you have one spark plug not firing, there have been people that have been fooled by that. They didn't even know it wasn't even working. It runs pretty good. And somebody who's with a trained ear will say, there's something off with your engine. There's a miss. He goes, really? I just thought the engine just runs that way. You get a couple of spark plugs out, it's going to run rough. Everyone's going to hear it. But it won't run at all with one. It just won't. What if, instead of talking about the causes that mean something to us, how to live a healthy life, how to pick the right education for our kids, how to do this or that on the Sabbath, instead of that, we focus on what we can positively do to come together. And we make that one possible statement that we're going to post one of those spark plug type posts. A happy one of some sort. Doesn't have to be, you know, Christ is returning. Doesn't have to be that every time. But what if you were the one that were going around and filling empty cups? And you only felt good when you were filling the cups of others. If you do it by yourself, you might get burned out, and I can tell you, hang in there. But when you see one or two other people doing it with you, all of a sudden, it kind of becomes infectious. You know, when I'm trying to light a fire, yes, you can pour gasoline on wood and light it from, you know, a distance with a spark. If you don't have gasoline, you might need kindling or newspaper or something else to get it going. But I'm lazy, and I don't like making kindling. So I've got a torch, not a lighter, but a torch. And I take two pieces of wood, and I until they're burning. But I can't do it with one log. It will never work with one log. What I like to do is I like to have one log a little bit off the ground so air can come there, and I take two facing half logs. I lay one up against the side of the stove, and I prop the other one up with a quarter. So I've got these two faces facing each other, and I get them close together, and then I hit the torch, and the two work off each other. When you get it going, you get this Venturi thing going up underneath them, and it'll just keep itself burning. Something I heard Les Babb, I don't know that he can take credit for inventing the phrase, but he told me, so I'm giving him credit. And he says, come on over and bring your warmth to the fire. Not come over here to the fire and get warm, but bring your warmth to the fire. Because the truth is, if everybody left the fire, there is no fire. Whatever hot embers are left quickly extinguish. But when each of us bring our heat to the fire, it's that whole stone soup thing. When everybody puts in what they've got, all of a sudden you've got something magical and wonderful And when you get enough people in the room filling other people's cups and worried about, I need to know them. I need to get to know them. I need to know more about them and less about telling them about me. Because that's what we're good at. Guess what I did last week? We're less good at, so what did you do last week? It's the same sentence almost. One's harder than the other. Especially when we're saying, what did you do last week? Because then I'm going to tell you what I did last week. It's harder to be a cup filler. But when you start seeing it happen, your cup fills up without you even realizing it. Where, you know, you say, well, are we saying that we're not important? The commandment is love your brother as yourself, not love your brother more than yourself. But if you're going to be equal in this love, then who gets to be first? How much time do you spend on yourself? I gotta get what I can out of life because life is short. So I gotta do what I gotta do. But if other people's needs are more important than ours, it doesn't mean we don't matter. But the way it works is when we're filling other people's cups and they start filling ours without us even knowing it, the next thing you know, everyone is full and now everyone is overflowing. The lesson from the speaking club offering was that all we gave was a little bit of the right attitude. That's all we put in. We put it in a little bit of the right attitude, and we felt good. We were excited to share the attitudes. God did the offering. God filled the buckets. God did everything else. All he wants from us is to put some skin in the game. If we are the kind of people that say, I don't really know how long I'm going to be here, but it doesn't matter. I'm in it for as long as it's going to be. Think about what God has on his plate right now. Great tribulation's coming. You know, they talk about nuclear war. There hasn't been talk of nuclear war in many, many years. It used to be all the rage. Yeah, there's a nuclear war coming to a continent near you. When I was a teenager and Ronald Reagan was running for president, that's all they talked about in my school, was that man's going to bring World War III. And there was talk about world war. They're starting to talk about that kind of stuff again. Think about what's on God's plate. He's got a great tribulation. And he looks at us. And I know what's going through his mind. Are they ready? Are they ready for the tribulation that's coming? I mean, up till now, we've been talking about how we could preach the gospel. But God is thinking, are they ready for the tribulation? Do they have what it takes? Because up till now, they've been waiting. There hasn't been heat. There hasn't been really anything bad other than a sore butt from sitting. It's going to get much, much worse. If anyone is low on oil, he ain't going to make it. I can promise you now. You might say, hey, I've made it this long. I can make it the rest of the way. That may be true if all you have to do now, between now and then, is wait. If all we have ahead of us is waiting, you might be able to be there for the count. But are you up for the tribulation? Are you ready for that? What we need in really tough times is family. What we need in the worst time in our lives is one another. And why would God bring anyone into a church where people aren't first and foremost for one another. That they're for themselves. That they see Facebook posts that talk about anything but something hopeful. And to you, it might be hopeful. To you, it might be, you know what? When you have a dog in your car, it needs to wear a helmet. That might be your cause. Dogs need to wear helmets. That could be everything to you. Are you going to die on that hill? Is that your one shot to communicate to the whole world? If you can just get your dog safe, everything is going to work out. We have such a limited opportunity to reach out and make a difference. I said earlier, for you people who don't have anything to do with Facebook, I'm not just talking to the people online. We all do it. We may not type it, but we all do it. We sit around and we talk about, you know, such and such is an idiot. I can't believe we have an idiot at the helm. And people say, oh, I know who he's talking about. Well, it depends. Are you the person who thinks the current guy's an idiot or the last guy's an idiot? Because that pretty much speaks for a lot of people in the church. The last guy was an idiot. No, the current guy's an idiot. Who does that win? Who says, oh, yeah, I'm with you? Well, yeah, somebody who also thinks that guy's an idiot. But the person who doesn't think that guy's an idiot, you've lost them. You split your audience. Wherever you divide people, you split your audience, and now nobody wants to hear what you've got to say, except the people who are already on your side. And you're not winning anyone over when you're just preaching to the choir, which is where that phrase comes from. It doesn't do any good. The only way we can reach new people is that we have to forge bonds with people, that we have to become family with one another, and that we have to become a cup filler. And that role in life needs to be what we're all about. That I come here to fill cups. I'm not coming here to get my cup filled. And if I do it right, and enough people do it right, my cup will get filled anyway, which is kind of how God wants it to work. And then when we're doing this, and I'm not saying we're not. This isn't a horrible corrective sermon. You people are terrible and you need to shape up. This is a message going out to the whole church. And so as a whole church, I think every one of us can learn something about it. You could be one of the biggest cup fillers in this room. And there are some great cup fillers in this room. There are some great cup fillers. And there's something you can learn through this fast. What more can God do with me? Maybe I wasn't meant to be somebody that just gave my talent back with interest. Maybe God expected me to come back with a couple more. You know, the analogy is, you know, whether you have your interest, whether you have 5 or you have 10. Those aren't your only choices. You know, maybe for now you start with one extra talent. And if you manage that well, God will say, you know, let's give him a couple more because you managed it well. He'll eventually might get up to 10. That's great. But we start small and we just, what did God give me? What am I supposed to be here for? What am I not doing? Who do I see in this room that seems down and could use some encouragement? I know that's going to take a lot out of my cup to put it in someone else's cup. But if I do play my cards right, someone else will fill my cup and I'll have more to give. And if everybody starts out with one cup, by the time you dump it in everybody else's cup, you spill some, you lose some. There's never enough so that everyone's cup is filled. And that's how physics works. But the lesson we learned at that offering was God doesn't care a whit about physics sometimes. He says, I dare you to try to outgive me. I dare you. So it doesn't matter when we think, you know, am I going to really spend my time encouraging someone? They're just going to bring me down. Maybe, and maybe not. So as we kind of go through the rest of this day, probably won't feel like staying here till the last moment today because of, you know, some of us go through headaches. Some of us go through some of the worst. I'm just glad that my stomach hasn't helped the message today by projecting any of its noises. It was sure doing that on the way down here. But let's think about these things with the remainder of our day. Why has God called me? Why am I in this room? He has a purpose for me. And it isn't to wait until He returns and gives me a job. That doesn't mean you might think you know what you want to do and therefore you just got to get out of my way because I'm going to do it. It's about listening to God to say, maybe there's something I had no idea that I would ever give such a thing in my life or share myself in such a way. And that's outside of my comfort zone. And maybe that's what we're listening to have God tell us. Yeah, but that's what I want you to share. That's what fasting is all about. Is having us listen to Him to have Him show us what He's seen in us that we have held back. So instead of a one-fisted cup filler, we're a two-fisted cup filler. And maybe that's what we've been called to be.